a lot of questions as I was hoping for. And so my goal today is to try to answer as many as possible. And I'm going to start with the Facebook questions and also live questions. So if you guys have any questions, you're allowed to go in here and you can go in the chat box on the sidebar on the right, which you can probably see down here, and you can type in your question. Now, I'm not going to be able to get to all of them today because there's a lot, but what I am going to try to do is respond to those questions either future conferences or future videos or future articles. So your questions are important to me, they're important to your patients, so let's move forward and get right to it. Let's see. So I'm going to drag these Facebook questions over now. And on the Facebook question here, we've got a very common question. And I've done a video response to this in the past. And it was from Jose here. I have homozygous COM-T and compound heterozygous MTHFR. So for COM-T, they recommended hydroxy B12. But for MTHFR, they recommended methyl B12. There is a contradiction. Absolutely, there's a contradiction. And there's a contradiction because I lost my webcam. Where'd it go? Dang it. Hold on. Where'd it go? Dang it. There it is. Good. So the contradiction is because these recommendations are treating the SNP instead of the patient. So if you're treating the SNP instead of the patient, you're going to get conflicting issues. So for COM-T, that requires methyltransferase. It's methyltransferase enzymes, and you want to support it with methylation. But some people's methylation isn't working. So in this particular question, you're isolating the SNP instead of evaluating the patient. There are some patients that are going to do very well with SAMe who have COM-T variants. There are some patients who are going to do very well with hydroxy B12. There are going to be some patients who do well with methylcobalamin. So it all depends on the patient. So we need to stop looking at these SNPs in isolation and addressing the patient. And I recently did a video with Mike Mutzel where we talked about COM-T and MTHFR. And that is on YouTube. And I will take a note right now. And I will also do I think I've also done a video on this in isolation of my own, which I'll send you. So I'm going to make a video a reminder to send all you guys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, a video on this COM-T MTHFR issue. So the bottom line is this contradiction is happening because people are treating SNPs instead of the patient, and we got to stop doing that because the epigenetic control is what we need to be focusing on. And how do you determine which type to use? Well, that depends on how the methylation status is doing in general in the patient, which would take a whole hour to discuss that. Angela Heap, she asked, I'm really interested in a link to Down syndrome and homocysteine levels. Can you go into this a bit more in terms of where the blockages are in the methylation cycle and as to why homocysteine builds up? First, we have to identify why Down syndrome has even occurred. So Down syndrome is the risk is high in women who have elevated homocysteine during pregnancy. So the goal is to support methylation during pregnancy, identify homocysteine levels, and get them optimized to about 7 or so during pregnancy. If you do that, the risk for Down syndrome drops significantly, and that's what we need to be doing, okay? So in order to prevent or reduce the incidence of Down syndrome, you must identify homocysteine levels. And elevated homocysteine levels are indeed a sign of methylation dysfunction. So we want to make sure that that is addressed. I'm going to close this. Okay. Now, in terms of where the blockages are in the methylation cycle, it can be anywhere. I mean, the methylation cycle blockages can be in the methionine synthase enzyme, which is the main hub where MTHFR works in with MTR. And those blockages can be heavy metals. They can be B12 or folate deficiencies. They could be oxidative stress. They could be lead or mercury. They could be yeast overgrowth. They could be lack of dietary intake of these nutrients. And They can be lead, mercury, I think I've already said that, and so on. So if you look at the pathway planner, which I have over here, second. I need to get a smaller one. So I just moved. This is my new office, but so you can see all the purple there by MTR. See all that purple? Those are inhibitors of methionine synthase. And the methylcobalamin is the vitamin B12, which supports MTR, and the methylfolate supports MTR. So if you get a blockage there, then homocysteine is going to accumulate, and the blockages in that area can occur for numerous reasons. So do you recommend eating a less animal protein-rich diet to help those who have an MTHFR, A12 and ANDH-C and BH4 problems? Well, again, we need to focus on not treating the SNP, okay? We need to focus on treating the patient. So if a patient has elevated ammonia, we should evaluate how much protein they're eating and possibly consider a ketogenic diet. Now, ketogenic diet is going to reduce the ammonia that is coming into the system, because ammonia is coming from the protein breakdown. Ammonia does also come from pathogens and an inhibited ammonia cycle. So we need to identify the reasons for a blocked ammonia cycle, and that can be a number of reasons, and also researching some areas in there. Now, in terms of biopterin, biopterin does indeed work with neurotransmission and nitric oxide, and arginine goes to nitric oxide. So if you have a high protein diet and you are building up your ammonia levels, then you are supposedly getting enough arginine, right? And then arginine will support your nitric oxide. That's beneficial, very beneficial. But if there's oxidative stress, then the problem is that arginine will not move to nitric oxide very well, and then you can get cardiovascular disease and blood pressure issues. And in terms of addressing a particular SNP, such as MTHFR 1298, and saying that you reduce protein intake based upon a SNP, no. You reduce protein intake in order to optimize ammonia levels in patients, and you want to use the ratio approximately of 0.8 grams of protein per 2.2 pounds of body weight. So that's a general recommendation, okay? And a lot of patients are not balancing their protein intake appropriately, which is causing neurotransmitter issues and energy issues and muscle issues, okay? So again, the mindset of treating SNPs must go. Another popular question on Facebook here, trying to find another one. What is the difference between a cofactor and a promoter? Great question. The difference between a cofactor and a promoter is a cofactor is the necessary nutrient needed for that particular enzyme to function. So enzymes use various nutrients, and once the nutrient binds to that enzyme goes, oh, it's time to go to work, okay? The alarm clock is in your room. When the alarm clock goes off, you wake up. When the cofactor binds to the enzyme, it wakes up and it goes to work. Now, if there's a cofactor plus a promoter, so if there is an alarm clock in your bedroom plus a can of cold water getting dumped on your head, that's going to get you up a lot faster. So that's the difference between a promoter and a cofactor. A cofactor is a required nutrient for that particular enzyme to work. A promoter is something which makes the enzyme work faster outside of the cofactor. Now the question is, will a promoter induce enzymatic function without the cofactor? I would say it probably depends. So if we look at our particular enzyme on the pathway planner, which I now have on the floor, let's talk about CBS. So CBS, a promoter for CBS is SAMe, So as soon as a lot of SAMe levels come into the body or produced by the body, that's going to tell the CBS enzyme to go faster. And it wants the CBS enzyme to go faster because it has too much SAMe in the system and it needs to get it out. So it tells CBS to, hey, help me get rid of this SAMe and let's pee it out. So SAMe is a promoter of the CBS enzyme to make it work faster in the event that there is too much SAMe in the body. Now, vitamin B6 is the cofactor for CBS. So if somebody has high levels of SAMe but are deficient in vitamin B6, I don't think that the CBS enzyme would work very well. I think that actually elevated SAMe would be converting into SAW and then converting into homocysteine. That homocysteine will accumulate and end up inhibiting your methylation, and the homocysteine will tend to accumulate and cause issues in your patients. So with that example, I think it is important to support both cofactor and consider the impact of promoters. And my research is constantly increasing. I recently found, I don't think it's on the current pathway planner, but testosterone is an inhibitor of the CBS enzyme. How much testosterone and how much inhibitor is it? And I think the term also of promoter is going to change, because one of the researchers I work with informed me that we should probably change that, because a promoter is something that helps promote gene transcription and reading of the gene, but we're actually talking about inducing the enzyme to work faster. So we'll talk about in the next conference. We'll clear that up. Okay. Somebody asked, where is the webinar? It's right here. Let's see. Another question. I want to see if there's any live questions. It's a lot. I want to see from you guys. Rose, are you seeing any questions from the audience? Oh, here we go.
I'm not.
I see the question box. Here is one. Okay, yes, I see them now. Excellent. How does lithium affect serotonin and GABA? I am not sure. I don't know. Oh, no. Stop. Sorry. All right, webcam, try this again. For some reason, my webcam decided to stop. But it's all right. Doesn't matter. Instead, I'm going to open a pathway planner for you guys. Because that is going to be more useful. So here's a pathway planner for methionine cycle. So how does lithium affect serotonin and GABA? I can't answer that, I'm sorry, but it is something I've been looking into and I'm trying to resolve it. When is using adenosylcobalamin form of B12 most needed? Great question. Now, adenosylcobalamin, there's a few things you should know about that. And the primary thing you should know about adenosylcobalamin is it is the mitochondrial form of vitamin B12. Methylcobalamin gets converted to adenosylcobalamin. And let's see if I can find transsulfuration here. Yes. So here you can see that adenosylcobalamin is the cofactor for this enzyme to convert methylmalonyl-CoA into succinyl-CoA. So if your patient has elevated methylmalonyl-CoA, they need adenosylcobalamin to reduce urinary MMA. So some of you guys order urinary methylmalonic acid in order to identify vitamin B12 deficiencies. But what you are specifically identifying is the adenosylcobalamin form of a vitamin B12 deficiency. So if you give a cyanocobalamin or a methylcobalamin or hydroxycobalamin to a patient with elevated methylmalonic acid, your patient might be able to convert that B12 into the mitochondrial form. But if you want to specifically target it and say that the patient is resistant to lowering their methylmalonic acid using those other forms of B12, then you would go for targeting directly of using the adenosylcobalamin. The other thing you should know, since it is a mitochondrial form of vitamin B12, it is the most, the most oxidizing. It's the most potential, has the most potential to increase reactive oxygen species in your patient. Well, why is that? Because if you're supporting the mitochondria, you're supporting basically the utilization of oxygen and transforming it into ATP. And it is that process which naturally causes reactive oxygen species. So the mitochondria naturally produce superoxide and hydrogen peroxide. So if you are supporting the mitochondria in a patient who is predisposed to reactive oxygen species already due to glutathione deficiencies or superoxide dismutase polymorphisms or glutathione polymorphisms or deletions, or their high stress that's producing a lot of hydrogen peroxide, then you got to be careful. If you push adenosylcobalamin to these patients who are susceptible to reactive oxygen species, or they already have high amounts of oxidative stress, then I highly encourage you to give glutathione and possibly superoxide dismutase or NRF2 promoters, or evaluate their red blood cell manganese or zinc or copper, as these are the cofactors, as you can see right here, of SOD. So here's SOD here with these nutrients, and here's your hydrogen peroxide, which your glutathione recycles. So in summary, adenosylcobalamin is the mitochondrial form of B12 that's specific to reducing methylmalonyl-CoA, and there are genetic polymorphisms that are present in the population which reduce the patient's ability to convert methylcobalamin to adenosylcobalamin. Keep that in mind. They are out there. It's a great question. I am very interested in views regarding Parkinson's disease. My client is MTHFR 1298 heterozygous. She has only been recently diagnosed and is obviously interested in further, well, I wouldn't say further progression, further understanding possibly. I have her on many supplements and wanting to help as much as possible. Thanks, Karen. Great question, Karen. And what I am seeing currently with this, and I have not seen many labs of Parkinson's patients yet, but what I am seeing currently is there are polymorphisms in the superoxide dismutase pathway, the glutathione peroxidase and glutathione transferase, and anything related to glutathione. And so if we have patients who have disturbances in their ability to get rid of superoxide or hydroxyl groups or hydrogen peroxide, then these things are going to cause oxidative damage, and they're going to damage the mitochondria from further working. It's going to start damaging the brain. It's going to start releasing a bunch of glutamate in the brain. It's going to start damaging the cell membranes. The cellular communication is going to go down. And so we need to identify anything that increases the production of superoxide and anything that increases the production of hydrogen peroxide or hydroxyl groups, or here's peroxynitrate. So that is step one. Step two is you have to look at methylation dysfunction. And I have seen a genetic lab of a specific patient of a doctor who had symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And what that doctor had found, she gave me the report, and I looked through it, and I isolated a phosphatidylcholine polymorphism, so PEMT, so phosphatidylcholine production was reduced. MTHFR 677 was present. SOD polymorphisms were present. Glutathione deletions were present. There were, I think, a FUT2, FUT2 polymorphism was there. Transcobalamin 2 was there. So the ability to carry vitamin B12 and deliver it to where it needs to be was present, along with other folate SNPs. So this is a beautiful thing of genetics. And this is where we need to, as physicians and health professionals, is where we need to identify and use genetic testing. This is the gold mine of seeing these genetic susceptibilities in oxidative stress, methylation dysfunction, cell membrane function, mitochondrial dysfunction. If we can identify these problems in patients and we can say, look, you have potentials for increased oxidative stress, increased cell damage, increased methylation dysfunction, if we can identify those and support our patients through lifestyle, diet, and the environment, that is a beautiful thing. And that is where genetic medicine needs to go. And instead of saying, look, I have Parkinson's disease and I have MTHFR1298, I'm going to take more methylfolate. No, we have to look at the patient as a whole. We have to look at the environment as a whole, and we have to look at the combination of all the SNPs that we understand as being clinically relevant. And I can tell you right now that there's a lot of SNPs that are being identified with all these different lab testings in lab interpretation reports that I believe are bogus. And it is frustrating to me, it's frustrating to you, and it's causing fear and confusion in your patient. So what I am really working hard on doing, along with my research team, which is small but mighty and growing, is identifying these key SNPs. And I will reassure you that the amount of SNPs that are clinically relevant is actually quite low. Quite low. So go back to this Parkinson's disease patient. You need to look for polymorphisms that are relevant to transsulfuration, which is in this pathway here, and you want to look at methylation polymorphisms, which are here. So you got MTR, which is kind of questionable. There are some SNPs that are definitely an issue and some that aren't that you're aware of. MTGFR is a definite problem. CBS down regulations are an issue. When I say down regulation, I mean that it's slowed down. Okay. So if somebody says the CBS gene is downregulated, that means it works slower, okay? And upregulation means it works faster. BHMT, I'm not finding much. So Parkinson's, if there's a CBS downregulation, MTHFR polymorphisms, MTR issues, and these I'm still evaluating. And then you got SOD, glutathione issues down here. Obviously, a G6PD would be a nightmare. SUOX is increasing sulfites, and sulfites cause a lot of problems. They increase histamine and, a lot of other things. So great question. I'd be looking at heavy metals as well. I'd be supporting this patient absolutely with NRF2 combinations, glutathione, and evaluating and possibly considering a ketogenic diet. I'm going to delete this question. I don't know how to do this very well. Okay. Come on. Okay, question here. Seeing Health PQQ. Lozenge versus Dave Asprey's unfair advantage. Is it the same or different regarding bioavailability or not? I'm not sure. I don't look at other people's products very much. The reason I put PQQ in a lozenge is because I want to enhance the delivery. And I know if you put a nutrient sublingually or just allow to dissolve in the mouth, that the delivery should be pretty good. Obviously, it depends on the nutrient. Obviously, if it's a fat-soluble one and there's no bile in the mouth, then that's kind of a stupid one to consider as a lozenge. But PQQ is a nutrient that I am currently pretty impressed with. my knowledge of it isn't where it needs to be, but it is also on the, it's a cofactor from the conversion of dopamine to norepinephrine. So people who have elevated dopamine and low norepinephrine, it might be a consideration to give them PQQ. Now, if they have elevated norepinephrine or they're anxious and irritable, then I probably would not be giving them PQQ. I utilize PQQ currently for those who are athletic, in terms of doing athletics. Okay, so if you're running and you are participating in soccer games or basketball games or tennis matches or CrossFit or what have you, taking PQQ prior to a competition might enhance your ability to perform. Is yet to really be seen because it is new for us, but something I'm evaluating. So in terms of who's better, I don't know. Try. Let's see here. BH4 support. Okay, thoughts, considerations regarding choosing best supports for BH4. Now, BH4, let me get this here for you. Where is it? Here. So first of all, to define BH4 for some of you, and I go into BH4 quite a bit in part one and part two conferences on seekinghealth.org. So if you want to learn a lot of information about biopterin, biopterin recycling, oxidative stress, COMT, MAO-A, all the folate pathways, go into seekinghealth.org and registering for part one and part two is very highly recommended. So, and with any of our courses, if you find it's not useful, just call our support team and they'll refund you, all right? So BH4 is a very important compound that is produced in the biopterin pathway. And this particular inquiry is regarding the recycling of biopterin. Now, I'm trying to figure out how to redraw this diagram to make it more clear. But the goal here is you want to have biopterin here, dihydrobiopterin, recycle into tetrahydrobiopterin. And biopterin is a kind of a cofactor, if you will, to convert phenylalanine to tyrosine, tyrosine to L-DOPA, tryptophan to 5-HTP, and arginine to nitric oxide. If you have inadequate reduced biopterin, which is here, and high levels of oxidized biopterin, then giving a biopterin supplement might help. But according to the research, and as explained in part one, by giving biopterin to patients who have oxidative stress is like pouring a bucket of water on a forest fire. It doesn't do much. So you need to be able to identify oxidative stress and reduce it. So to me, the best way to support biopterin levels are, one, get rid of folic acid. And why do you do that? You get rid of folic acid because folic acid goes through the same enzyme as oxidized biopterin goes through. So dihydrobiopterin is here. It goes through dihydrofolate reductase enzyme, which is where also folic acid comes through. So this is an old pathway planner. I have more current ones. And folic acid is actually an inhibitor of DHFR. And it's an inhibitor of DHFR. And I would classify it as a competitive inhibitor because there's only so much enzyme available in the patient. And if they are taking folic acid, DHFR has to metabolize it and convert it through DHFR. Now, if there's a lot of oxidative stress and there's a lot of oxidative stress going on and it's attacking your patient's biopterin and causing oxidized biopterin, and that oxidized biopterin is trying to get through dihydrofolate reductase, but your patient is taking energy bars and supplements and eating enriched folate or folic acid containing foods, then the oxidized biopterin has to wait in line in order for that folic acid to get out of there. And to let you know, the dihydrofolate reductase enzyme is very, very slow. So if your patient is taking folic acid, they need to stop. Now that means folic acid enriched foods. It means folic acid containing supplementation. It means folic acids, energy bars, and so on. Out of the system, they need to increase folate-containing foods, i.e. leafy greens. That's a great thing to do for patients. Then you need to identify what forms of folate work best for that patient. Maybe it's folinic acid or methylfolate. Now, those methylfolates has been shown to support the recycling of oxidized biotin. So, number one, to support oxidized biotin, get rid of folic acid. Number two, get rid of oxidative stress. And basically, you need to couple NOS. And all that is evaluated here. So you need to support methylfolate levels through leafy greens. You need to reduce oxidized glutathione and give more reduced forms of glutathione. You need to reduce homocysteine and asymmetric dimethylarginine, which is unfortunately a very expensive lab test, which is a shame. And you need support with arginine. So if your patient is a vegetarian, not eating nuts, arginine is in a lot of nuts, right? So if your patient is low in arginine, you need to increase that. If they're too high in arginine with oxidative stress, that could be possibly uncoupling this, increasing superoxide, which then is uncoupling this and increasing oxidized biotin. So what you want to do is, again, folic acid removal, give some glutathione support, evaluate methylfolate levels, reduce homocysteine levels, and there are things out there like royal jelly. I think PQQ was also supportive of biotin, but I could be incorrect on that. And I've got, again, I'm from memory, but a lot more of this is in the part one information, part one conference. So let's see. Another one for biotin support is propolis. Propolis is supportive for biotin. Now, remember, don't just target biotin. If you order a Neopterin biotin panel, then you don't really know how much of that biotin is oxidized, because the labs can only identify biotin, and they're not quantifying how much oxidized biotin there is compared to reduced biotin. So if you order glutathione levels and the glutathione levels are low, and you order a lipid peroxide levels and those lipid peroxides are high, or you order 8-hydroxydeguanosine, that DNA damage marker, however you say that, and that's also elevated, or you've got elevated hsCRP, then and elevated homocysteine, then you can, by looking at those in themselves, then you can assume that that patient has more elevated oxidized biotin. Ammonia management, that is complicated, but ammonia management, first you want to evaluate protein intake. You want to evaluate the digestive ability of your patient, how well they're able to break down protein, and if they're actually digesting it, or if it's just letting it rot in their gut. So stomach acids, pancreatic enzymes, the amount of protein they're eating, also pathogens, how much pathogens are in their system. H. pylori is a producer of ammonia, along with others. Lyme, I believe, any pathogen is going to possibly increase ammonia. And then you also have the ammonia cycle is going to be inhibited, and I'm still working on that. I'm going to be discussing this a lot more in detail in the upcoming conference this October, because ammonia is a big problem for mitochondrial function. And if we have mitochondrial dysfunction, our patient isn't going to be doing well. So identifying elevated ammonia and getting out of the system is something that we need to be focusing on. Butyrate, I found to do really well at reducing ammonia levels in patients. I've also found acetyl-L-carnitine does quite well in reducing ammonia also. Vitamin B6, reducing protein intake, and identifying and eliminating pathogens. And ammonia, the primary route of ammonia elimination is mitochondria. So the mitochondria in the liver are required to eliminate and process ammonia. So if your mitochondria in your patient are not optimal, then ammonia levels are going to be an issue. And that is probably why acetyl L-carnitine works quite well. And I would move your patient cautiously, to a ketogenic, at least a more ketogenic diet, okay? There's a book out there called Keto Clarity, and Keto Clarity is a book that I read that is pretty good. But what I found on a ketogenic diet is you do really well initially, and you feel great, actually, because you reduce the burden of the liver. You reduce the burden in terms of protein, that is. You reduce ammonia levels, which are no longer sapping your nutrients to process ammonia. And you are obtaining fuels that are longer lasting and storable. Protein is not a storage fuel. Protein is utilized by the body as it's ingested, and then it's eliminated. So if you eat this huge steak, you get the protein from that, then you have to process all that ammonia, and whatever fuel is there, it's just wasted. You just pee it out, poo it out. It's complete waste. So minimizing and optimizing protein intake is where you need to be. And fuel from fat is stored, and it also provides a lot more energy for when it does get burned. But you have to optimize the mitochondria and the ability for your mitochondria to utilize that fuel. And again, I get more in depth on that this fall. And another issue that I found with the ketogenic diet is if the adrenals are not optimized, then the blood sugar can swing. So you need to optimize the adrenals in your patient with adaptogens and possibly adrenal cortex. And I like using adaptogens first, because if you give adrenal cortex to a stressed out patient, it can stress them out and cause even more issues. So I like giving adaptogens first. They're more subtle, and see how they respond to those. If they respond favorably, then that might be all you need, and you don't need the adrenal cortex. And then I also found that electrolytes are needed. And then you also want to have some carbohydrate, especially in the evening, so you can sleep. If you're eating a ketogenic diet, your ability to obtain tryptophan is down. So you got to make sure you're getting enough tryptophan. And the reason for that, as you can see here, tryptophan goes to 5-HTP, which goes to serotonin, which then goes to melatonin. So that is an important nutrient. Or you can supplement with 5-HTP if you prefer that. That is a FYI, because I was on the ketogenic diet for about, I think I was doing fantastic for about 2 weeks, and then I started carbohydrate binging because I was low in tryptophan, because you're not getting much tryptophan from meat because of competitive issues with absorption. Another question here, two bad copies of superoxide dismutase, what to do for this? So superoxide dismutase is the enzyme which is important for processing superoxide. So you can see here the cofactors for superoxide dismutase are copper, zinc, and manganese, and it depends on where the SOD polymorphism is and where the particular SOD gene is. There's mitochondrial SOD, and there's cytosolic SOD, and what you'd want to do is you want to check your red blood cell manganese levels in your patients. You also want to check the red blood cell zinc and copper. So if these amounts are normal, great. If they're low, then you need support. Okay, that's what you want to evaluate, because it looks at the functional capacity of the SOD system to work. If the manganese, zinc, and copper levels, if any of those are low, then in combination with the SOD polymorphism, you are going to have a even more dysfunctional superoxide gene. So what you need to keep in mind is, as you support with manganese, zinc, and copper, the superoxide is going to get transformed into hydrogen peroxide. This transformation is then going to put burden on the glutathione peroxidase enzyme. So if you're just supporting your SOD polymorphism, again, treating the SNP, without identifying a possible elevation of hydrogen peroxide or deficiency in selenium or riboflavin, you're going to increase hydrogen peroxide in your patient. That is not good. So before you support upstream with the cofactors needed for superoxide dismutase of copper, zinc, and manganese, regardless of a polymorphism or not, you need to make sure that your patient is able to process the hydrogen peroxide. So in order to do that, you can make sure that their selenium levels are okay and their riboflavin levels are okay. And you can evaluate riboflavin levels by evaluating urinary organic acids, and you can look at selenium levels by ordering a selenium level in your lab. So, and there are polymorphisms in these areas as well, along with deletions. So, but again, I would, before I give any upstream support, I'd work with the downstream support first. So it's, I use a bucket example, as a lot of people do. If you've got a glass of water or a bucket and it's 3/4 of the way full, and you then take a bigger bucket and you start filling that smaller bucket up with water, it's going to overflow. And that overflowing is going to cause a problem. So you got to make sure that the hydrogen peroxide bucket is not being overburdened. Because if you push SOD to convert superoxide into more hydrogen peroxide, you're going to cause problems in your patient. So again, supporting selenium, riboflavin, glutathione, and these nutrients is important. And I will say that I'm really excited about a supplement, conflict of interest here, seeking help, but something that you should know about. It's a product called Oxidatix, and it does supply zinc and manganese, acetylglutathione, selenium and riboflavin, and superoxide dismutase all in one supplement. So you're handling the recycling, the utilization, and the prevention of overflowing buckets. I'm excited to see how that works. Dr. Benz, there remains a disagreement in the field about the small use of folic acid, Walsh and Yasko, or avoiding it if MTHFR, DHFR, FOLR2, SLC, etc., which I believe you follow, and I've been as well. Can you please briefly discuss and give your thoughts about this? Thank you. Do you see folic acid anywhere in nature? Is there folic acid found in any natural substance on this planet? No. Why would we, you think that utilizing a small amount of a artificial nutrient that is not found in nature, why would we think that's useful when we have in our hands the ability to use what is available in nature? And that is 5-methylfolate, which is here, and folinic acid, which is 5-formyl tetrahydrofolate. I don't understand any of the confusion of giving an upstream folic acid, which is synthetic, to come through here, slow the dihydrofolate reductase enzyme, which then slows the biopterin recycling, which then affects your neurotransmission and your cardiovascular function. And the dihydrofolate reductase enzyme research, as discussed in part one, the dihydrofolate reductase enzyme research that was done shows that it's very fast in rats and it's very slow in humans. So I'm of the camp that if you are going to ingest a little bit of folic acid, you know, say from enriched foods, you go to a restaurant, I think ideally you don't do that, but we're all human. We're going to eat some of that stuff. That's fine. But intentionally supplementing with a little bit of folic acid, I vehemently disagree with. I just disagree with it. Now, in vegetables, there are about 1 to 200 different types of folates found in leafy greens. And foliage is the root of the term folate. So F-O-L, right? Foliage, folate. So on seekinghealth.org/gift, there's a video that goes into folate metabolism and talks about the various types of forms of folate available. So I am of the camp where folic acid should be avoided, and we should be eating leafy greens, and we should be utilizing the nutrients of folinic acid and methylfolate for various reasons, and also partly because you cannot find folic acid in nature. It slows the hydrofolate reductase. It reduces the folate binding protein. It downregulates those, and it blocks folate receptors in the body. And that also messes up with the ability to deliver effective folate forms through breast milk to get to the the infant. So if you're taking folic acid, that infant is relying upon the mother to be delivering the reduced forms. And if that mother is taking folic acid instead of methylfolate, eating her leafy greens, or taking folinic acid, then that baby is also going to be deficient in these reduced forms of folate. So no, I do not use folic acid ever. I never recommend it. It is my understanding that blood levels of ammonia do not indicate brain levels of ammonia. I have found urine and blood levels to not be consistent. What are your thoughts on measuring ammonia? I talked to Dr. David Quigg on this. Urinary ammonia and blood levels of ammonia will vary. And I'm trying to remember what he told me, and I'm shamefully forgetting exactly what he told me, but I will write this question down, and I will remind myself, and I will make a video of how to measure ammonia and make that available to you guys, because Dr. Quigg informed me that measuring ammonia is very, it's basically not going to be very consistent, as you're finding, and it varies tremendously, and you might miss what's going on. And elevated ammonia, you will catch if it's very high. If it's on the border, you might miss. And again, I'm not going to say which one is better, urinary or blood, because I don't want to be wrong. So I'll ask Dr. Quigg on that, and then I'll be specifically addressing this by video, because that's a great question. Thanks for that. Can I comment on the overlap of histamine problems and methylation problems? Yes, great question. So I've got videos. In fact, I've got a whole article on histamine intolerance on mthfr.net, and this video goes in depth about histamine intolerance and the different causes for it. And there's also videos on YouTube where I talk about histamine intolerance and methylation problems. Histamine and methylation are united in some areas, and they're not in others. So it all depends on the causes of elevated histamine. So as there are many reasons for elevated histamine. So we need to be able to pinpoint what these different causes are, identify them, and remove them. Because you can have multiple causes of elevated histamine, and methylation may not be really be a problem in this particular in a specific patient. So there are, for example, you've got HNMT, which is an enzyme, histamine and methyltransferase. And this enzyme, what it does is it processes histamine, and it uses SAMe to do that. So methylation and histamine metabolism are absolutely directly 100% linked. If your patient has a HNMT problem, their intracellular histamine levels are going to be elevated. And if they're elevated, they're going to have histamine problems, such as skin disorders, breathing disorders, insomnia, headaches, and so on. All these things have, and also premenstrual cramping and so on. All these things are having to be associated with intracellular histamine. And that is directly linked to methylation, absolutely. Now, you also have elevated histamine levels that come from bacteria in the gut, and they also come from food that is ingested. So, and that is extracellular histamine levels, which can become intracellular. So, and they become intracellular because you absorb that extracellular histamine, and it can get into the system and cause havoc such as asthma and skin disorders and so on. So these things are found in histamine-containing foods and drinks, especially. If you're drinking something such as orange juice, can be high in histamine. Pineapple juice is also very high in histamine. And if you give somebody a good test, if you want to test it on yourself or somebody else, wake up in the morning, empty stomach, drink some orange juice or drink some pineapple juice and see how you do. If you get sweaty and hot, or you get cramps, or you get a headache, or you get flushing or skin irritation, then you might be overwhelming your Dao enzyme. And Dao enzyme is also very polymorphic. So in the population, and I discussed the DAO enzyme in part two video course at length. I don't talk about HNMT. Unfortunately, 23andMe does not address HNMT polymorphisms, which is very sad because HNMT is very clinically relevant, very polymorphic, and very common. And if your patients walk in with breathing disorders and skin disorders or menstrual disorders, you need to be evaluating HNMT. And there's also other disorders, which I'm forgetting. Okay. So they are linked, and you can go on YouTube, which I'll be directing you guys later through seekinghealth.org. And seekinghealth.org, there is a learning center, which I'll be providing a lot more videos. I've got a lot of videos. I think I just shot 13 videos in the last 2 weeks. And these are bite-sized videos that are about 6 minutes long, which are packed with clinically relevant information for you guys, which you can get just take away right away and give to your patient. Now, where I want to end with this is complicated, and I also want to say that I've learned a lot. Yes, I have a website called mtshafar.net, but what people need to understand is my story briefly here. So I got very sick in India. That sickness in India I regained my health quickly with Ayurvedic medicine. Ayurvedic medicine led me to Bastyr. At Bastyr, I obtained my naturopathic doctorate, and while I was at Bastyr, I was working with patients, and I found out patients who did well and others who didn't. So then I focused on environmental medicine. Environmental medicine, I started using that, and I identified that some patients got better, some got worse. So I said there must be a genetic component. So I started looking at genetics. MTHFR was the first gene that I identified. So it was a really big one. I started working with MTHFR. Some patients got better, some patients got worse. And then I started connecting it. And I started connecting all these different genes, and that's where part one conference came into play. Part one conference, I talk about all these different genetic polymorphisms, which are common in the population, especially in the folate pathway, glutathione, oxidative stress pathways, and so on. And then I realized that doctors were emailing me and say, you know, look, I'm treating this, I'm treating that, I'm not getting any success. That led me to part two. Part two, I realized, hey, you guys need to start focusing on the epigenetics. So do I. We need to stop treating the SNPs, use the SNPs to guide our treatment plans a bit and identify where we're blocked and prevent disease and dysfunction in our patients and to identify which nutrients we should use and which we shouldn't and what we should do first in our patients. And let's do that. And I focused on neurotransmission because that's a big problem for us, it's a big pain point. And I also talked about histamine intolerance because that's a huge pain point. And then I started getting doctor emails coming in and saying, hey, look, you know, I'm doing the epigenetics. I'm doing that. I'm doing the lifestyle. I'm doing the diet. I'm doing all these things, but I'm still not getting anywhere. I'm getting somewhere, but in my difficult patients, I'm still not getting the results that I want. And that led me to part three, which is coming up this October in Denver. And what I found is if we support methylation or we identify SNPs and work on those, but we're not addressing the cell membranes, we're not addressing the mitochondria, and we're not addressing some of these underlying SNPs or approaching methylation prior to dealing with these things, then we're wasting our time, we're getting frustrated. We're then saying that treating the SNPs or identifying polymorphisms in our patients is a waste of time. It's not. It's just that we're using them wrong. And so we need to really focus on identifying mitochondrial dysfunction. If your patient comes in and they're tired and you learned that hydrogen peroxide inhibits the Krebs cycle. Now, would you think identifying an MTHFR 1298 and treating that is more important than learning that hydrogen peroxide inhibits the patient's Krebs cycle? No, you wouldn't. So that's how I've evolved. I've evolved from identifying and teaching the importance of MTHFR, which is great, which we need. But we also need to know the Krebs cycle. We also need to know it outside of where we learned it in school. And I can tell you, I am blown away from all the stuff that I'm reading. Let me show you something really quick here. So if we're not focusing on the mitochondria and cell membranes in our patient, those are the core organelles. They're the absolute core organelles. If they're not working, your patient's not working. So this is KICA, which is a research program that I use, which I love, okay? And I've got all sorts of stuff on here on the mitochondria. Now, what I want to share with you guys in also is this October, if you don't know about it already, because I've been so busy researching and doing other things, but at Seeking Health Educational Institute, we're hosting an upcoming conference in Denver, Colorado, and I'm going to be discussing mitochondrial function and basically the dysfunctions, how to identify it, and what the mitochondria do. They don't just produce ATP. They don't just tell cells to die, okay? And I can tell you that what I learned in med school is nowhere near where I've learned about mitochondria now. So I'm going to be teaching you and giving you insight about mitochondrial function and cell membrane health. If your patient's diabetic, they can't get the glucose into the cell. There's glucose receptors in the cell membrane. The cell membranes are damaged. How are your patients going to get glucose into the cell? So if you're focused on all these things, their diet and everything else, but their cell membranes aren't working, how are they going to get the glucose in there? It's not going to work very well. You've got to identify the cell membrane issues. You've got to restore it. Mitochondrial function. If your patient gets a little bit of exercise and they start walking and they get fatigued, did you know that at 40% of the body's ATP is used up at rest, on simply pumping magnesium into the cell, calcium out of the cell, pumping potassium into the cell? If these things are not getting inside the cell, if your patient's RBC magnesium is low, then maybe it's because their ATP production is low. And that means their mitochondrial function isn't right. And electrolytes are the key communicators to the cell. And electrolyte ATP production is the key to methylation. If you have inadequate ATP production, how are you thinking you are going to support their methylation? You're not. Now let me show you here. ATP is needed to convert methionine to SAMe. Wow. Okay. Exercise-induced asthma. Teaching you guys how to get rid of it. Get rid of it. Gone. I've done it in 4 kids, working on a 5th right now. So as a thank you for attending this webinar, people who register for the upcoming SeekingHealth.org conference are going to be getting a voucher to get $250 worth of free Seeking Health products. Okay. So at the start of the Seeking Health Educational Institute conference, day one, you'll be given the voucher for $250 worth of free product at SeekingHealth.com. And there's going to be tools for you, for your patients. Not only are you going to be learning about this stuff, and I'm talking about education only. I'm not going to be up on stage talking about supplements and my own supplements. I'm going to be talking about how you guys can take clinical action on various issues. And this is probably the only conference that I know of that is absolutely guaranteed. If you are not satisfied with the information that you get at ChiCon 15, I refund you. Now, it's a 4-day conference. It's long, and it's long because I've got 5 other physicians presenting besides myself. We have case studies all day on Sunday. That pathway planner, that poster, I'm going over all day on Thursday on how to use it. So you stare at it, you don't necessarily know how to use it. I've written various scenarios. Say your patient is iron deficient, they have low RBC manganese, and they are complaining of fatigue, and you have given iron and they respond very unfavorably. What happened? And we are going to follow on the pathway planner. What happened? You gave glutathione to your patient. They did poorly. What happened? Why? Now, these are hypothetical, but I can tell you that there are many doctors who are getting great results through utilizing the pathway planner and marking it up and using it. So I'm spending all day Thursday on that. And Saturday or Friday and Saturday, I'm discussing cell membranes, mitochondrial function, and we're also going to be discussing vaccinations and how to identify which patients are more at risk for vaccine harm and what we should do about it, and also the safety overall of vaccines. It's a hot topic, and I don't want it shoved under the carpet. We need to talk about it. So we're going to be talking about that as well. And lunches are on me, okay? So when you guys are at lunch and you fly from some of you coming across the world to come to this conference, we have people coming from Korea, Japan, Australia, UK, New Zealand, and so on. If you're flying all the way here, do you want to be sitting in a room during lunch and networking with other physicians, or do you want to be marketed to and sold to? You want to be networking. You want to be learning more about what other doctors are doing. So this event is going to be really focused on networking, and the organizers and myself are really focusing on how to really engage you guys to network with each other, more than just giving business cards. We're going to give special badges, which allow you guys to sit with the same specialties for one lunch. So if you're a pediatrician, you're going to be lunching with other pediatricians. I want you guys to be communicating and how you should approach this, okay, approach this type of medicine, because we are transforming medicine, and you guys I'm very thankful for, because you are out in the trenches dealing with this every day. And my goal is to make it as simple as possible. And so with this conference is going to be very clinically relevant. There is going to be some theory, but there's going to be a lot of science, and you cannot establish new paradigms in medicine without pushing the paradigm of pushing the envelope, and pushing that envelope comes with theories, and it also comes with experience and collaborating with 400 other like-minded physicians in the same room is going to be phenomenal, and it's going to empower us to make the right decisions with our patients. So I'm excited for this conference. I'm preparing hard for it, and I really want to see you guys there. And just to say thank you for coming here and giving me your fantastic questions. $250 off, or actually free $250 worth of product at seekinghealth.com, which you'll get. And in order to get that, you need to register within 24 hours of this webinar. So again, in order to get the $250 worth of free Seeking Health product, please register for the conference at seekinghealth.org. Register today or tomorrow, and we will get you that voucher. And we also have payment plans available, and the four-day conference. We really also want to encourage you to reserve the hotel, because it's a lot cheaper. So as soon as you register for the conference, make sure you reserve that room, because we have a limited number of rooms available. Rose, do you have any comments for people?
No, if you do have any questions, feel free to email events@seekinghealth.org, and we'll continue to try to just answer any questions that you might have in regards to the conference. And also, like Dr. Ben said, we will address these questions later in various articles, forums, and so don't want to feel like you didn't get heard, but there's just a lot of questions to answer.
Yeah, and I'm going to be writing all your questions down. So all the questions that came in by email, I have. All the questions that came in by Facebook, I have, and all these questions here, I'm not going to shut this webinar down until I copy and paste them. So I'm going to try to figure out how to do that, and I will take care of it for you. And there is going to be a new planner released at seekinghealth.org, and it might be free, it might not be, so we will see. And we have they'll be dining outside also in beautiful Colorado. It'll be covered in case it rains, but it's going to be a great experience. So again, please go to seekinghealth.org, and I really want to meet you guys. I want to hear your stories. I want to hear your troubles. I want to hear your successes, and I want to find health professionals who get this, and I want to work with you closely and take this to the next level. So thank you for your support. And keep knocking away at this. You're pioneering this area of medicine, and keep giving me your questions. Thanks a lot for your time today.